Good morning. I'm Erin McCabe, and I am the Director of Care here at Midtown 12 South. And I'm so excited. If you have been here for the past few weeks, you may have heard us talk about a new team that is being formed called our Mercy Team. And I'll be leading that team, and that group of people will be asked to lead our church in caring for the internal needs of our church, things like meals and prayer, and if someone's in the hospital, going to visit them. And then they will also be loving our city and leading us in partnering with our missional partners throughout the city and thinking of ways that we can get involved with those partners. And then this team will also be leading in partnering our congregation with the Napier congregation. And I'm really excited about this team getting started. Some of you have already been asked to be a part of it, and a few more of you will be asked to be a part of it as well. And I think this will be a great opportunity for the Lord to work in our church. And now I'm going to get to introduce you to some dear friends, Harrison and Emily Gashu, and they're going to come tell you a little bit about their heart for the Napier community and their story and how our church has come around them and loved them as they have loved some teenagers in Napier.
Good morning, y'all. We are the Gashaws, Harrison and Emily. We've been attending Midtown for about 6 years now and been members here for the past three. And we are both honored to share with you guys today what the Lord has been doing in our lives alongside Midtown 12 South.
Okay, so I have a little bit of timeline to break everything down. So Harrison and I moved here summer of 2020. We had just graduated from the University of Georgia, and I got a job. Go Dogs! I got a job working at Two Rivers Middle School, and this was during the time of COVID, where students weren't coming in person, and I really quickly saw that there was a lot of needs for our students that were not being met. So the Lord was really working. He put my classroom across from Nicole Vaughn, who is now one of the staff members at Napier Kitchen Table. And she showed me how to get involved in the Napier community. We began taking meals to students and computers and hotspots. And we would just go into their homes and sit with the families, talk with them. And this really opened up the door to build relationships with my students and their families. After this, I also began coaching at our schools or at our school sports and realized a lot of students wanted to play sports, but they didn't have transportation. So I started taking kids home after the practices and games, and we started organizing vans to help take kids so that they could be involved in the school. And through this, built really strong relationships with a few of my students, particularly a group of siblings that Harrison and I started taking to sporting events, and we would have them over for meals, and they eventually began attending church with us here. And throughout the years, I moved schools, Harrison and I got engaged and married, and the Lord just kept calling me back to the community and to this group of students. And by summer of 2024, Harrison and I both individually felt the Holy Spirit saying to us, like, these siblings, they're going to come live with you. And we were like, yeah, sure, okay. We were newlyweds. We lived in a super small townhome, and we were really confused. I was like, I hear you, but not really sure how that's going to happen. And 2 months later, Jasmine moved into our home, and we got custody of her about a month later. And we had to pray through her brother and what that would look like, because at the time we just didn't have the space or the resources to care for both of them. And another total Lord thing, I was eating lunch with my school librarian, and out of the blue she was like, you know, me and my husband have started considering foster care. And I was like, don't say that. I have I have a kid for you. And he actually ended up moving in with them a few weeks later. And she and her husband were able to care for him until we were able to get a bigger space to live and kind of have more resources to take care of him. And so May of 2025, her brother Roman moved in with us, and we got custody of him just a few months after that, and we started our journey as a family of four. And it's been a wild journey. We're still learning how to be adults. We're still learning how to be married, and we're definitely learning how to be guardians of teenagers. They're now 15 and almost 17. And so I really thought we could do it on our own. I was wrong. I was dead wrong. So we had to really learn how to lean into our church family and the Lord, because we couldn't do it on our own. So Harrison's going to talk a little bit about how the church has supported us through that.
Yeah, for sure. We would not be able to be here right now and care for Jasmine Roman if it wasn't for Midtown and Midtown 12 South. You know, it starts with like the leadership team. As soon as they kind of heard about our situation, they were there for us. They covered us with prayer, guidance, phone calls, texts daily, you know, just checking in on us. And it wasn't, you know, just Elliot and Daryl. It was also Roy Roper and the rest of the elders, Aaron McKay, Matt Ackerman. I mean, just everybody was checking in on us, which we needed at that time because we were just a little lost. And then our small group, the Lord blessed us with Chris and Janie Omer, who have been like our parents here in Nashville. And they have provided us just with endless amount of support and just a family, like I said, away from home. And the Lord kind of hand selected, you know, for us to be in that group. And Sarah Camp was actually in that group, which was just a huge blessing because she's a CASA advocate. And at 26 and 27, we had no idea how to navigate the court system. And she just, I mean, was there for us daily. So thank you for that. Thank you, Jesus, honestly. Crowded Tables. It's just been the most amazing team of people. It's a team run by Francie Brooks, and it's a lot of younger families. Most of them have, you know, younger children. And what they do for us, you know, they're praying daily. They bring us meals twice a week, and they provide rides for Jasmine and Roman when Emily and I can't provide, which has just been a huge, huge help and assistance. And you know, something for us, we get asked all the time, you know, we don't have family here in Nashville. All of our family's in Georgia, and, you know, all of our family friends, like, when are you guys moving back? And, you know, we tell them, like, hey, yeah, we miss you guys, but our family's here. It's Midtown. Midtown has just become the biggest blessing in our life, and, you know, we can't leave you guys. So thank you all for being who you are.
So to kind of wrap it all up, I just wanted to encourage anybody, if you need care, I thought I could do it on our own. We thought we could have done it on our own. We couldn't. The church is so amazing and has such a wonderful care team. Don't ever be afraid to reach out and ask. Aaron McCabe is so wonderful at facilitating care. And also, if you want to support families like us who need care, also reach out to Erin because she's wonderful at getting people plugged in and can tell you more about the different organizations that we have available. So thank you all for your time.
Good job. Good job. Good job. Way to go. Good job on the mic. I guess it was maybe a year and a half ago when all that was first starting and y'all were trying to get custody for Jasmine, and Aaron called me, or Emily called me. I was walking into a staff, like, all-day summit we were doing, and she was like, I'm so sorry to call. And I was like, no, it's fine. How'd you get this number? But no, it's fine. I was hearing about the situation, and I knew what they were involved with, and we started talking through, and I was like, all right, well, Aaron's going to reach out later. Aaron McCabe, who y'all heard from just a few minutes ago, director of care. She's also going to be directing our Mercy team. But then she started telling me, like, well, we're in the Omer small group. And the camps are in that small group. And I was like, what do you need me for? Which really is a display of the body of Christ, which if you're new here, like not as involved here, like we really do want to care for the needs, not just of our city, but care for the needs of each other, especially those that are caring for our city. And so it was beautiful to be like, oh, thank you for telling me about this. We will pray for you. And there's a lot going on. Elders will be praying, but you have the hands and feet of Jesus like with you, which is the church. So it's really beautiful. It's one of the ways the Mercy team will continue to expand and grow in caring for the needs of our people inside these walls and outside these walls to bring mercy to the city, which is what we're talking about in the month of January. We're preaching through a series called Mercy Made Visible, which is always the call of God's people and always has been since the beginning of God's people, is to make mercy more visible. And so we are doing that by studying a little passage in the book of Micah. And a little context for that is that Micah is an Old Testament minor prophet. First five chapters of Micah is letting God's people know judgment is coming, judgment is coming, judgment is coming because of your sin and idolatry and self-righteousness and arrogance and your neglect of the poor among you. Judgment is coming. The Babylonians are going to come and take you captive. And so then as chapter 6 begins, the people of God kind of speaking through Micah, the representative, they're kind of crying back out to the Lord through Micah to say like, well, hey, don't let judgment come. Like, can't we kind of call this even? What do you need from us to give to you? What kind of, how big does the check need to be for us to write back to you for you not to have the Babylonians come and take us captive? So that's kind of the first part of our little section. And then verse 8, which we'll read here in a second, is God's response through Micah to, it's not a transaction you need. It's actually a transformation you need. Let me tell you what that transformation is supposed to look like to be God's people in the world. So that's the context for Micah. That's kind of guided our whole January mini-series for 3 weeks that we wrap up today of what does it mean to be a people who are making mercy visible through justice and mercy, and then finally this last pillar today of humility. So here we go. This is Micah chapter 6, starting in verse 6. First two verses are the people telling God, what do we got to do to make you not judge us? And then Micah saying in verse 8 actually what they need. So verse 6, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? It's like a hot commodity, like a young calf was a big deal. Then verse 7, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, which is an enormous amount of rams, and 10,000s of rivers of oil? So much money to provide that. Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Like, what do you need me to pay you back with, God? In verse 8, he has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness or to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Walk humbly. Walk with humility. Why does Micah close out his little Pinteresty three pillars of these three embodiments of mercy in the world to be what the people of God are to be and become? Why does he close it out with humility? Why is humility the end of the list? Why is humility so important for the people of God? Andrew Murray, who was a Scottish missionary to South Africa about 100 or so years ago, said, mankind's whole relationship to God is to be marked by an all-pervading humility. Without humility, there can be no true abiding in God's presence and no experience of his love. And a lack of humility, Andrew Murray would say, is the explanation of every defect and failure. And more famously, early church father, St. Augustine, you guys say Augustine, but it's St. Augustine, was writing to a young Christian who was asking him, how do I follow the way of Jesus? What do I need? Like, what tools do I need to be on the way to become more and more like Jesus? And this is in a letter written by St. Augustine to this young man. He said, the way first is humility, and the second is humility, and the third is humility. Humility, humility, humility. See, what the Bible would have us come to understand is not that humility is a virtue amongst other virtues. Humility is actually like the soil in which all other virtues grow. Because humility is way more than just something you go and practice, you go and try to do more of. Humility is actually a way of being. It's a way of seeing yourself in relationship to the world and to each other and to the Lord. It is an identity statement. Do you see yourself humbly? Do you walk humbly? Do you see yourself in the world with humility? That's why Micah closes out the list with humility, because what he's saying is that you are to do justice and you are to love mercy, but without humility, you won't do either one of them. Without humility, you won't do any of these things to be the people of God. And so the challenge for us today, one of the challenges in our day, in our context, in our cultural moment, post-enlightenment, post-modernly speaking, where we find ourselves, humility is like in this camp that most people would say, like, that's a fine kind of noble spiritual pursuit, But it's not really fitting with the modern telos, the modern aim of life, the modern like North Star of what people want to be and become and achieve and accomplish in this life. Humility is not at the top of people's list. Humility doesn't, I learned in some study this week through some commentaries and scholars on this topic would say humility is essentially void in all modern psychological and therapeutic training. Like it doesn't exist in journals or in grad schools. Sigmund Freud, one of the fathers of modern psychology and therapy, used the word humility 9 times in like 2 million words of writing. Like it was, and it wasn't even ever that he had a section on it. It was like he would add it on as an adverb here or there. There are plenty of examples to show of the lack of interest that modern social sciences have with humility because it just gets kind of tagged over. It's like, well, it's fine if like those spiritual people, it's fine if those Buddhists, it's fine if those Christians, if you have like a spiritual pursuit, it's fine if you want to embody humility, but that's not a worthy topic psychologically or therapeutically speaking for us. See, the spirit that we're all swimming in, no one gets out of this alive. Everyone's in this tidal wave. We are swimming in these waters. You live in an ocean that places its emphasis for your life. The telos for your life is on individuality, is on assertiveness, is on independence and introspection. So you're taught, we're taught, I'm taught by the waters we're swimming in to do these things of the highest value. Know yourself, love yourself, take care of yourself, and those are all really important things. I'm not demeaning those things. But those things have their place, but they come at the expense of the pursuit of humility. Humility doesn't have a place in the framework of just be yourself, just know yourself, be the best you you can be, become independent in your pursuit of the good life for you. But here's what's interesting is that everyone in the room, everyone I know, wants everyone they know to be more humble. Everyone wants everyone else to be more humble. But very rarely do you meet someone, very rarely do I meet with someone who would say, you know what I really want to do in my life? I want to be more humble. And even more rare do you find someone in that pursuit of humility that is rare, where they would even think, I probably need to become more humble. We don't see ourselves that way. We're on a quest that sets us on a different trajectory. But then it's not just the 21st century moment we're in that would make humility a hard pursuit. That's not something you're going to be encouraged to pursue. We have a warped view of it, especially in the church. I'm talking to those of you who have grown up in or around or church adjacent. We have a view of humility that was set by some early church fathers and monastic fathers, and it's very natural to think this way when it comes to humility, but it lingers today that there's like this monastic view of humility that looks a lot like self-abasement. It looks a lot like self-deprecation. It looks a lot like living your life like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh, where it's like, oh, I'm kind of the worst, and I kind of just like only talk terrible about myself, and woe is me, and woe is the world, and nothing is good in me, and nothing is good in the world. We have this picture of humility that is full of despair, that comes with a strong sense of personal inferiority in relationship to everything else. And that's not biblical humility either, to be like self-abasing and self-deprecating only. So if you take all of it, kind of this historical trajectory that we're naturally prone to and the modern moment we're in, we have this tension where even if you don't say it out loud, if you're a Christian or you find yourself in the way of Jesus, here's what a lot of people will often think when it comes to this relationship between the modern pursuit of life and, oh yeah, there is that Bible that tells me I should be humble. How am I supposed to be humble and still feel good about myself? How do I do that? How can I be humble and still be driven? Look, we live in a town that loves self-promotion, and I'm not just talking to the musicians and the artists in the room. Everybody in this town loves to self-promote, and so everyone that is calling themselves a Christian in the way of Jesus is dealing with this tension of like, how do I be humble and go accomplish all the things I want to accomplish? How do I be humble and still be fully me at the same time? Like that's the tension we're in. So let's talk about it. What is humility, and what does Micah mean when he commands us to walk humbly? Well, biblically speaking, it's actually really hard to define. Like there's not one place or one verse or one section that defines humility. Here's what the Bible does. It gives a lot of pictures of humility, a lot of lives that were marked by humility. And then what the Bible does, because it's an Eastern document, not a Western document, it speaks in metaphor, it speaks in illustration for us to wrestle with. And it, do you know that the three most common metaphors, the three most common illustrations that the Bible would give for humanity to see themselves rightly are these three metaphors? We are to see ourselves as sheep, we are to see ourselves as children, and we are to see ourselves as servants. Sheep, children, and servants. That's what Christians, that if you belong to Jesus, that's what you are. If you want to be fully human, those are the images you have to embrace. You are called to see yourself that way. So what's the connection between those three? To be a sheep, to be a child, and to be a servant. Well, all three of them, the thread that connects them is that none of them are full of themselves. None of them are completely self-dependent. All of them, sheep, children, and servants, presume a humility, a humbleness. See, what's common about these metaphors, sheep, child, and servant, is that they are all right-sized. And I don't mean right-sized only in the like seeing yourself smaller, but here's what right-sized means. It means you don't see yourself too big and you don't see yourself too small. You see yourself right-sized, the way you were made to be, the way you were intended to be. You don't think too highly of yourself, nor do you think too lowly of yourself. Not being too big or not being too small in your view of yourself, which is why C.S. Lewis famously said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. Humility would direct us to stay within our proper frame. Like, we don't presume too much about ourselves, but we also don't, our proper frame does include a dignity and an excellency that doesn't think too lowly about ourselves. It's our proper frame, our intended frame. And you can almost tell, it's hard to define, but you can almost tell, you can almost smell in experiences and interactions on TV, online, when someone's not being humble. You're like, I don't know what that was, but it wasn't humble. Like, you don't necessarily know exactly how to define it, but you certainly can tell when it's not happening. The experience of humility. So, if humility is the right sizing of ourself and our view of ourself in relationship to the world and ourself and the Lord, what would foster a right-sized view of self? Well, the first place to go would be to the beginning. How were you created? What is the intention and the original design of humanity? Because in the beginning is where we get what it means to be fully human. It's where we get our identity. It's where we get our definition of what it means to be human and fully alive. What were we intended for? And in the beginning, here's one thing you'll discover if you read the opening pages of the Bible, is that you will find that humanity was made. Which may not sound like rocket science or newsflash, but here's what that means. You are made in the image of the Creator, yes, but made nonetheless, which means this, you are a creature. You are not the Creator. And so our original design right sizes us. We are creatures. To be a creature presumes a humility because guess what? You didn't create yourself. You were made by a maker. You were made by a creator. So get this. If creatureliness presumes a humility, and in the beginning, your original design was to see yourself as a creature, which comes with humility, do you know that humility is what you were designed for? You were designed to be humble. So humility makes you human. Humility, true humility, restores you to your original design by restoring to you your right size. You are a human being that was created by a maker. You are a blip on the timeline of history. No one in three or four generations will remember your life or your name. You know how I know that? Because you can't name to me your great-great-great-grandfather or grandmother. Don't act like you can. You can't. Like, it is a right sizing to realize, like, oh, I am not the infinite one. I am not the creator. I don't see myself too highly. I don't take myself in my life. I don't assign to it an over amount of importance. But here's what's crazy about true humility. What's crazy about being restored to the right size view of ourselves, not oversizing our place or our importance. We don't see ourselves as too big, but we also don't see ourselves as too small. And this is maybe the most upside down, backwards thing that humility does to us, true humility. Do you know that true humility instills deep confidence? Everyone in the room wants more confidence. But we think there's like this bravado or this thing that like, I've got to add to myself these things to gain more confidence. I need to go read more, be more, work out more, accomplish more, think more, whatever it is. I have to change something about me and my status to gain more confidence. It's actually upside down in the kingdom. Humility instills confidence. And here's how. Creatures that were created, which is our right size, our right design, creatures that were created, but not just created, created with dignity, created with purpose, created with love. Do you know your maker made you because he loves you? And so a creature that was made out of love, a creature that was made with purpose, actually that creature can beam with confidence. Do you know why? Because the way that you're made, the gifts you've been given, the talent you've been given, the color of hair you've been given, like, do you know your maker gave you those things? The one that made you with love, the one that made you with design, the one that made you with care, that's how your maker made you. Do you realize how confident that should make you in owning your talents, owning your gifts, owning your passions? Because you didn't make you, he did. You didn't create you, he did. And he thought quite fondly of the thing that he made you into when he knit you together in your mother's womb. He made you the way he wanted to make you, to be you, because as Anne Lamott says, everyone else is taken. The way he made you with the talents and gifts he gave you were to be enjoyed and confidently walked in. Like, you ought to be beaming at the way God made you and the way that the talents he's given you and the gifts he's given you. Like, are you a good songwriter? Are you a poet? Are you a cook? Are you good at hospitality? Are you good at spreadsheets? I'm not. Are you good at organization? Are you good at thinking through systems? Are you good at thinking through visions? Are you good at creating things? Are you good at making things? Are you good at saving lives? Are you good at reading and becoming? What are you good at? Revel in those things. Do not back down from those things. Your maker gave you those things. He wants you to own those things. He wants you to enjoy doing those things. Where you don't walk in a room like, well, I'm not really so good at this. I guess it's like, no. God made you good at those things. God gave you those talents to those things. Own them. Walk into them confidently. How do you look? God made you look that way. Not all of you, but no, I'm kidding. God designed you to look that way. So you should be confident in the way that you look because your maker thought you should look that way. You were created that way. Walk in confidence and enjoyment. Don't see yourself too lowly. Do you know, like, over self-deprecation is also pride? Like, oh, I'm not. It's like, you're only thinking about you. Go use those gifts. Go enjoy them. He made you to use them. Humility is the way to confidence. C.S. Lewis, in Screwtape Letters, which is a book of letters written from Uncle Screwtape to his nephew, Wormwood, they're demons. And it's a demonic book. And Screwtape is writing letters to his nephew Wormwood about how are we going to deceive and keep our client, our human being that we've been assigned to. He's giving him tactics for the warfare. And in chapter 14, I went back and reread it this week, it's the chapter on humility. How do the demons, the enemy, want the humans to see themselves when it comes to humility? And how does God, who is their enemy, how does the enemy want them to see themselves? And what are they warring against? This is what C.S. Lewis says in Screwtape Letters. Fascinating book. Nothing's been written like Screwtape Letters in the last 100 years. It's unbelievable. But this is Screwtape talking to his nephew, and he says this. He says, the enemy, that's God, wants each man in the long run to be able to recognize all creatures, even himself, as glorious and excellent things. He wants to kill their animal self-love as soon as possible. Like the narcissistic, only obsessed with me love, animal self-love, as soon as possible. It's like, kill that. But that is his long-term policy, I fear, to restore to his creatures a new kind of self-love, a charity and gratitude for all selves, including their own. And then I love this. This punches real hard. When they have learned to love their neighbor as themselves, they will be allowed to love themselves as their neighbors. Like, that is a different way of talking about self-love than the world would tell you to talk about self-love. No. God wants you to see yourself as fearfully and wonderfully made, as excellently made, with gifts and passions and things that he would say, go use those things. Don't only use them for you. Go think about how you can use those things for everyone, because you're good at those things, because I made you good at those things. Seeing yourself as a creature made in the image of God, made with design and purpose and love, seeing yourself humbly actually instills in you a great confidence. And so, if you and I were made for humility, if humility is the ideal, it's what it means to be human, is to be humble, what gets in the way? What causes us to see ourselves as too big or too small? Well, it's the venom of the enemy. It's the antithesis of humility, and Andrew Murray would say, is the cause of all of our misery. It's pride and self-sufficiency. I'm linking those two together as synonyms. Pride and self-sufficiency. It's in all of us, and pride and self-sufficiency war with our humility every day. So how does one know that one is walking pridefully or self-sufficiently, full of self? What are the indicators? Well, in Micah, the book that Micah 6:8 comes from, he was calling out the pride in them by telling them to walk humbly. The pride that was on display for them was the pride that led to their exploitation of the weak and the vulnerable. That's why he used to tell them to do justly and love mercy, because they weren't doing that with the poor among them. He addresses in chapters 1 through 5 of Micah the powerful and the prestigious and the prideful so much. In the temple, in the church, in the religion, and outside of it. Like, priests were doing it, judges were doing it, businessmen were doing it, landowners were doing it. They were abusing the weak and the vulnerable out of their pride. That happens in this room too. But it's not the only way. The neglect of the weak, the exploitation of the weak and the vulnerable, is not the only way that pride and self-sufficiency manifests itself. And it's really helpful as we talk about what are a few indicators of pride and self-sufficiency in my life. It's really important that you don't think to yourself, this pride, I see this everywhere out there in the world. I see this everywhere with my in-laws. I see this everywhere with my spouse. I see this everywhere with my roommates. Like, that would be the prideful response to only think about like, oh yeah, this is where I see pride in other people. Here's where the antithesis of humility, pride and self-sufficiency, here's some indicators that you may be living in this way. First is a judgment of others. It's really hard to judge other people and not place yourself too highly above them. Looking down on them, having too high a view of yourself, casting judgment and condemnation against others. To judge presumes a pride. And maybe it's the week I'm having or the decade I'm having, but I cannot remember a day in like recent memory that at some point during the day, I didn't participate with some version of judging other people. At least sometime in the day, I spend judging my wife, judging my kids, judging people online, judging people I meet with. Y'all are so easy to judge. Y'all, it's so easy to feel so much better than you. And if you're like, I don't know if I'm really a judger, maybe I don't really judge other people. Here's one place that judgment comes out. Here's what wordless judgment sounds like. Like anytime you make that noise, you're judging other people. Even if you like make it under your breath, like like someone does something, you have some kind of collision with someone relationally, and all that can come out of you is like the disdain grunt. Like that thing, just take note of how often you make that noise. Judgment of others is an indicator of pride and self-sufficiency. How about this? This next one, another indicator of pride and self-sufficiency. You can't receive feedback. So we're gonna skip that one and go to the next one. No, I'm kidding. I don't really wanna talk about that one so much. Are you able to be approached by other people and those close to you to be told you have done something wrong? Can someone bring something to you that they have a criticism of about something you've done, some work you've completed, something you didn't do that you were supposed to do? Can someone bring something to you without you getting defensive? The proud and the self-sufficient cannot hear criticism and not get defensive. Your defensiveness, my defensiveness, refuses to let us admit and see places where we have done something wrong or hurtful or neglected to do something we should have. We cannot admit to that, because if we admit to that, then I am not self-sufficient anymore. So I have to hold on to that and defend the fact that you just are seeing it wrong, or you don't understand or get me, or that really hurt my feelings because what you really hurt is my pride and my self-sufficiency. So here's what I want you to do. Ask someone close to you this week what it's like to try to bring you something that you have done wrong. And by the way, that is not your time or your turn to tell them how they're not so great at bringing things to you. Okay? This seat is really fun. Do you know how many like spouses I'm seeing like lean over and do this right now? They're like, lunch should be fun. Here's the last one. Here's the last indicator that we're going to talk about today. There's plenty of others. But it's maybe the most painful one. It's maybe the most dangerous one as an example of pride and self-sufficiency, because this is the one that people are going to praise in you. Like, no one celebrates in you your judgment of others or your inability to receive criticism or feedback. But when you live this way, people are going to celebrate you for it. But it might actually be coming from a place of pride and self-sufficiency. It's when we attempt to live with no limits. It can look a bunch of different ways. It can look like you being overworked. It can look like you being overcommitted. It can look like you overperforming, overplanning, overpleasuring, like overvacationing, over extracurricular leisures. Like going beyond your limits, going beyond your capacities to try to prove something or accomplish something that might be really good. But to try to live with no limits. This one goes really deep, and our pride wants it to, because it's the one that very few people are going to call out in us. They're only going to give you more Q1 awards. They're only going to celebrate all that you have done and live beyond yourself. So how many of us have believed at one time or another in this living without limits framework that the goal of our life, the goal of growing, the goal of healing, the goal of maturing, the goal of what you were made to be in this world looks a whole lot like you becoming self-sufficient? Like, how many of you have thought at one time or another that the goal of your life is to arrive at the place in your life where you see everything on your own, so you have no more blind spots? You conquer everything on your own. Nothing is too difficult for you. You can handle it. You handle every situation with your own resources because you are self-made. You have done it. You rely exclusively on your own wisdom. Your identity is impenetrable. Like, you are so secure that nothing can ever threaten your identity. And you are never flustered, never tempted, never anxious, and never afraid. How many of you have thought that some version of that is where you're supposed to get to? The Bible would dismantle all of that. The Bible would be very clear in dismantling that ideology, and it would say this to you: the goal of your spiritual growth is not to get you to become more self-sufficient. That's not the goal of your spiritual or economical or social life. You have not arrived when you become self-sufficient. You actually maybe have destroyed yourself when you've deceived yourself into thinking you've become completely self-sufficient. And here's what's interesting about self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency, and I'm not trying to get too meta, it actually doesn't exist. Like, it's not a real thing. It's like atheism. It's not actually real. Self-sufficiency doesn't exist. You're a creature, remember, from the garden? Which means by definition, as a creature, not the creator, as a creature, you have limitations. You do not have the ability to be self-sufficient entirely. And here's what's interesting. If you go back to Genesis 1 and 2 and learn about the ideal of humanity, like, we are creatures made in God's image. You were made with limits. You were made with the inability to be self-sufficient before sin entered the picture. Which means this, you have limits and you are unable, by design of the designer, by design, you are unable to be utterly self-sufficient. It is not meant for, you are not working properly because it's not real if you are on a trajectory to become more self-sufficient because that's not how you were made. You were not made to be self-sufficient. You were made with limits. And so Kelly Capick, who's an author who I love, said it this way, sin didn't give you limits, God did. Like we think, ah, this like sin and evil and darkness and like limitations is this weakness that I've got to overcome with Jesus' help, sure, but like I've got to overcome to where I get to a place where I don't have limits anymore. So let me spend a bunch of time practicing my life like I don't have any limits. I'll go that fast. I'll agree to those things. I'll sign up. Guys, do you know how, like, I'm a father of five, okay? Talk about living without limits. And I do you know how often we do this to our kids? I know I don't have limits, but I'll make them act like they don't have any either. Like, I'll sign them up for all the sports and all the things and all the instruments and all the Jesus things. And, like, you will go do all the things. How often do we, like, model for kids the good life is having no limits? The good life is not saying no to things. See, whenever we attempt to live without limits, get this. If you understand your design, you're cutting against the grain of how you were made. You were not designed to do everything, be everything, accomplish everything, know everything, which is what AI wants you to think is possible. You were not made to understand everything. You are a creature. You have limits, and God designed you that way. And here's what else happens the more we try to live without limits. You actually become less and less human. You become less fully alive when you try to live without limits, even if you've deceived yourself. But here's what it actually means for your real life, like on a Thursday. If you pursue a life with no limits and do not embrace the limitations that you've been given, you will have less joy, less contentment, less peace. You will be less human. And you will certainly have less clarity of vision surrounding all the things that God has called his people to be in the world. Like how to bring the kingdom in this world doesn't look like you having no limits. Pride wants you to be self-sufficient. Humility wants you to see yourself right size like a sheep, a child, a servant, and be dependent to embrace your limits and to be right size. So how do we get there? We're going to go beyond the limits of this sermon time, I know that. But here we go. How do we see ourselves as a creature like this? Because I can tell you what you were designed for, but that doesn't just like seeing your design doesn't transform you. Because here's what we need. We don't just need like a model to see, oh, that's what it would look like to see ourselves with limits like the garden. We actually have to have something kill the power of pride and self-sufficiency in us. We have to be transformed into this. And so if you go back to our theme verse for the month, Micah 6:8, there's something profound in the phrasing of it that guides us into how we become it, how we become more humble. Reread verse 8 with me. It says, he has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness or love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Now, normally, if you've heard that verse before, normally we read that last little phrase, with your God, as applying to only the last pillar of walk humbly with your God. But what if the with your God was meant to go with each of the three pillars? So it would sound like this, that adverb phrase at the end, with your, I don't know if it's an adverb phrase, but it sounds like one. The phrase at the end, with your God, to do justice with your God, to love mercy with your God, and to walk humbly with your God. With your God goes with all three, not just the last one. And here's why it's saying it that way. Here's why Micah's phrasing it that way. You do these things with him because he's already doing these things. Go do justice with your God because that's what he's doing. Go love mercy with your God because that's what he's doing. Go walk humbly with your God because that's what he's doing. Do you know, not just according to Micah 6:8, but according to scripture, the Lord is the penultimate humble one. Philippians 2 in the New Testament is the seminal chapter on this for the New Testament. And Philippians 2 describes the most humble thing that has ever happened in the history of the world. It's called the incarnation. When the infinite one became finite. When the eternal one put on flesh and bone. And then Philippians 2 says, not just did the humble one incarnate in the person of Jesus, but the incarnation of Jesus was not just for a display of humility to say, hey, look at how humble I am. The incarnation of Jesus was about the sending of Jesus to die. And Philippians 2 says, you have never met such humility. If you want to know what humility is, go look at Jesus. But here's what's crazy about Philippians 2, when it describes the humility of the Godhead, when it describes the humility of the infinite one, when it describes the incarnation and the coming of Jesus to put on flesh and the coming of Jesus to live among us and the coming of Jesus to die among us and to be raised among us, here's what it says. Philippians 2 makes this claim. For him to do all those humble things, he actually wasn't acting out of accord with his own nature. Like when Jesus incarnated, he wasn't adding humility to his checklist of virtues to make sure he worked on. No. He incarnated because he was already humble. The Godhead was already humble. For him to be fully God meant he was fully humble, because to be in very nature God is to be in very nature a servant. He was acting out of who he was and is. He was not acting out of character. To be fully God is to be a humble servant. And Jesus came to make you more like him, because he's the ultimate human and he is a servant and he is humble. And here's how it happens. In the coming of that humble servant in Philippians 2 that describes the life and mission and death of Jesus, he didn't just come to show you what humility looked like. He actually came to liberate you from the power of what your pride and self-sufficiency believe is best for you. He came to transform you. He came to restore to you your humility, which is how you were designed to be. And he came to do that by killing sin and death and pride that had taken you away from humility. He came to restore you to your humanity. And so he was humiliated so that we would be humbled. And he took all of our prideful haughtiness and he didn't shame us with it, with what we've done to him. He actually paid for it. He took it on, 2 Corinthians 5 says. He became sin for us. He paid for it to release us from the power of it. Look, Jesus doesn't confront your pride with more shame, because shame is just pride's cloak. He confronts your pride with himself. And he says, let what I have done for you so overwhelm you that you actually put your sense of pride and self-sufficiency down. I'm releasing you from that pride. You don't have to be self-sufficient anymore. You don't have to do that anymore, because that's not who you are. He kills the pride and he crucifies it with him that we might be humbled. It's why I love the phrasing of Michael. He says, walk humbly with your God, not walk humiliated with your God. Like, it's not the like, oh, Lord, I'm so terrible and oh, woe is me. And there's a place for the humbling that our sin does for us. There's a place for that. But humility and humiliation are not the same thing. He came to free us from our self-sufficiency. And do you know the place where you are most deficient? Do you know the place where you are the least self-sufficient? And do you know the place where our pride gets us in the most amount of trouble? It's in our standing before him. Like, if you want to try to walk into your standing before the Lord pridefully, may God have mercy on you. Good luck with that. But humble Jesus even served us there too. He came to do for us what we could never do for ourselves. And so now we stand before the Lord humbly, yes, not humiliated. He's already paid for our pride. He's already atoned for it. He's already transformed us to restore us to our humble state. We come to him humbly. So over Christmas break, I started reading The Hiding Place by Corey Ten Boom. It's a great book. She's a Holocaust survivor. She lived in Holland. It's an incredible book. If you haven't read it, it should be required reading. I just became a Christian over Christmas break. It's awesome. It's an amazing book, and I'm about halfway through, but before the German invasion into Holland, Corrie ten Boom's aunt is dying. She got a death sentence from a doctor, and she's given a couple weeks to live, and her aunt lives with her. A lot of her family lives with her in this small town above the clock and watch shop that her dad runs in this little village in Holland. And her aunt is dying, and they all gather around, her other aunts, her sisters, her brother, to try to comfort their aunt on her deathbed. And the way they try to comfort her begins by them trying to give her confidence in dying, because her aunt was a wonderful woman who served so many in the city and the town and the village and brought everyone bread and raised money for orphans and spoke at different things to rally people to help those in her town. And so they're gathering around her to say, like, remember how many great things you've done? Like, you should die with confidence knowing you've lived a great life. And this is what her family literally says to her on her deathbed. Talking about when she like dies and then goes and meets Jesus. She says this. They say, you will run to him with hands full. All your writings, all your clubs, all the funds you've raised, all the talks you've given. Here's what they're saying. Run to him with all of your self-sufficiency. And after a few moments of silence, this is how her aunt replies on her deathbed. Empty, empty. She choked at last through her tears. How can we bring anything to God? What does he care for our little tricks and trinkets? We must come with empty hands, for he has done all on the cross. And all we need in life or death is to be sure of this. Empty, empty. How can we bring anything to God? What does he care for our little tricks and trinkets? We must come with empty hands, for he has done all on the cross. It's a pretty good display of what humility before the Lord looks like. And so if the opposite of humility is self-sufficiency, then humility, again, without giving a Webster's dictionary definition of it for you, the Bible would say it just looks a whole lot like dependency. It's the opposite of self-sufficiency. Now, it's not self-deprecating dependency. It's childlike, sheep-like dependence. So, 2026, if 3 weeks in, life is already making you feel again like you need a strength outside of your own, like you need a love outside of your own, if you need something greater than you to sustain you, carry you, transform you, and make you a great lover, if life is making you feel like you are remarkably not self-sufficient, that's great. It's actually the Lord in his kindness saying, yeah, you weren't meant to carry all this. You weren't meant to be able to do all those things on your own. You have limits. And so the response to walking humbly with Jesus is this, is saying, he was humble enough to come to us. Would you be humble enough to come to him? Come empty to him. Open your hands to him. Open your soul to him. Say to him, not my will, but yours. Come to him and ask him to right size you, not thinking of yourself too highly or too lowly. And walk humbly with your God. Let's pray and then we'll sing together. Jesus, the one who is in very nature God and the one who is in very nature a servant. Would your humility for our sakes transform us? Would your humiliation on a cross humble us in our hearts? Would we come to you turning our clenched fists into open hands? And instead of raging at the cosmos, instead of trying to be self-sufficient, instead of proving who we are, would we come empty to you? Embracing how you made us and celebrating that you love to do so. We ask all this in your name, Jesus. Amen.